So I think I'm going to end, you know, leave it here. And we have overextended ourselves. But if people have questions, I'll be happy to take them. Or not, as the case may be. Gib?
David, I'm really glad that you mentioned the importance of Apollinaire to the New York School. I mean, I don't think O'Hara would exist in the form he's in without Apollinaire.
Yeah.
Do you see specific Apollinaire poems in O'Hara's poem? Like, is the one that you started with seems to come out of the poem Little Blue Car, Little Red Car,
there's that poem about going to Deauville,
yeah.
Deauville, and also, I mean, Zone for all of these poets is, Zone is a very long poem by Apollinaire, which has been much translated by various people and influenced various people in very, very different ways. I mean, Merwin in some ways, Ginsberg is influenced in a completely different way. Ginsberg has a great poem. So the whole Apollinaire's book, Al-Kuls, you know, is one of the great foundational documents of the 20th century. And it has a wonderful sort of spirit to it. I mean, the other thing about all of these poets is that they, the New York School poets and Apollinaire and many of these French poets, were urban poets. They wanted to celebrate the urban, you know, and in a sense, American poetry of the mid-1950s, mainstream poetry, is not a poetry that's capable of doing that or interested in doing it. You know, much of it's still very much located in a kind of English pastoral tradition or very influenced by that lyric pastoral tradition. And so there's some, again, part of the risk-taking of the project is simply saying, hey, this is urban life. It's not ugly to us. You know, the cities were viewed as dangerous places, increasingly so. The people who lived in them, who slept in them, were weird and strange. Yeah. So yeah, so definitely Apollinaire, for sure. Yeah.
Just a tiny point, but when Creeley read Heroes, he added the word all in all those stories to Heroes, which results in the poem, and I didn't know whether he just did what we all sometimes do when we're reading a poem.
Yeah.
Or whether it was a word he took out and this is
I think that this, I'm not sure where I got this. I do remember. I got this from a website, a blog that Tom Clark runs, and just kind of copied it. And then, you know, but I think that he must have typed it in wrong because it is actually in all those stories. Yeah, that's the accurate thing. Yeah, Allison.
Just a comment to sort of tie a circle here. I love what you said at the beginning, that death is the summoner to poetry. I believe that's true. And coming to the Koch poem, you know, sort of two things are outside of the poem that inform my sense of the poem. One, that he is dying as he writes this. But the other is the way Delmar Schwartz dies. Because Delmar Schwartz does not die a pretty death. He dies impoverished in a hotel room, and he's lying there for God knows how long, a week or something.
Right.
Before anyone finds him. It's a terrible death of a poet who was, you know, celebrated, supposed to be the superstar brilliant.
Yeah.
Humboldt's Gift, the great novel, was based on John
Schwartz's
life. So it's a tragic poetic life. So those two things outside of the poem really make me feel the last line. You know, people say, yes, everyone's dying, but here, read this happy book on the subject, you know, the American way. You know, come on, self-help, it's just death.
Yeah.
But then the move, but here, read this happy book on the subject, not Delmar.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, way of seeing, being present to, you know, through the person of Delmar, sort of, rather than saying, I must face my own death, Delmar becomes the figure through which his presence,
that's right,
what is occurring, happens.
That's right.
That last line is just beautiful.
Yeah,
in the way it is.
Yeah, the sort of volta of, you know, when the turn takes place, not Delmar, not that rueful man. I mean, it's just a great example of how moving to a very different syntax and sentence phrasing, you know, suddenly changes the tonal value. And there's so much going on in a sort of at subtonal levels in all of these poems, but in this one in particular. And yeah, I liked what you said. I mean, there's a sort of honesty. There's a, one of the virtues of the New York School is a sort of honesty, you know, not a sort of commitment, you know, not to achieve transcendence through language, you know, cheaply, okay, but to look at something and to see what it is in itself, okay, and what it has to do with you, okay. And I like what he does with, I too like what he does, you know, with Schwartz, who was a really tragic figure. But in a way, he treats him as a sort of, you know, he's almost like a slapstick figure. There's something really sort of odd and kind of wonderful. I mean, you can feel the way in which Coke is kind of relating him to, like, Chaplin and Buster Keaton, you know. And I love that because the way that Schwartz has been treated largely in, Schwartz has been written about by a lot of people. John Berryman has a series of poems in the Dream Songs that are about Schwartz. They're very moving, you know, but they're memorializing this guy, you know, in some way. And even, you know, Humboldt's Gift by Saul Bellow, you know, does, there's a sort of grandness to this character, you know. And I like the way Coke goes back to this moment in memory. And he really brings it forward. You feel the image of this moment walking, this sort of, it's so silly, you know, in a way the poem begins, you know. Who was my teacher at Harvard, did not wear overcoat, saying to me as we walked across the yard, cold, brittle autumn is, you should be wearing overcoat. I said, you are not wearing overcoat. You know, there's something about there's almost like a parent-child, you know, thing going on there, I think. It's like a lot... This poem is from the last book that Coke wrote, which I'm forgetting the title of. Does anybody remember it? The book before that is an incredible book. It's one of the great books of the last 20 years, and it is called New Addresses. All the poems are odes. You know, some of them are dedicated to decades of his life. You know, to my 20s, to my 30s, you know, some of them are dedicated to concepts like, I don't know, to ephemerality, you know, or to the moral universe. Some of them are addressing, there's a great one called To Marijuana, you know, and he explains why he doesn't write, you know, when he's high on pot, or, you know, and what it does to him. This incredible image of him throwing his glasses into a fireplace, you know, trying to impress some woman. That book is just the book of a lifetime, you know, and I would urge you all to read it. Yeah. So, one more.
Okay. Comes your reading in 2 days.
Yeah.
So this is kind of a pre-reading
yeah.
question.
Yep. You're cheating.
Cheating.
That's not in my contract. I actually can't do
that.
Yeah.
I know it's late.
Yeah.
Obviously, or maybe not, the New York School has influenced your own writing.
Yeah.
And also the influence of the art of the period influenced their writing.
Yeah. As far as that art, you know, yeah, in particular the work of Philip Guston. Guston's a very interesting figure in the American art world because he started off as one of these action painters, you know, and he's one of the major figures among the abstract expressionists, Klein, de Kooning, Pollock, Guston. There's somebody I'm leaving out. Rauschenberg's actually just 5 years or 10 years later. Rauschenberg is part of that Larry Rivers Red Grooms thing that is the transition into pop art, you know, but that is slightly reacting to the grandeur and heroism of the abstract expressionists. And all of these people, you know, again, knew each other. But Guston, you know, his early paintings, they're beautiful. I mean, really, really beautiful paintings. Incredibly, to see them in person, they're incredibly textured. They're just layered in sort of amazing ways. They're the most subtle, I think, of all of the action painters. And then in the mid-60s, he just smashed it. He smashed his style. It's one of the rare examples of somebody breaking their style totally. And he started doing these very cartoony paintings and drawings, and they're filled with a lot of the stuff that actually is in a lot of the New York School poems. It's poets, crapola. Philip Roth has this great phrase. It's like the crapola of American life. You know, that's what we should be getting into literature. And you feel like they're just nails that somebody's like hammered down into a board, like boots that are piled up in a big pile. They're very strange and like put together in odd ways. They're very, in some ways, you know, they're cartoony, but they're also realistic. So when he started showing them, in, 1967, 68, he had a big show in New York, and he actually left town because he went to Venice because he knew like there was going to be this horrifying reaction to it. And the New York Times, Hilton Kramer, was then the art critic for the New York Times, the headline of that review was "A Mandarin Pretending to Be a Stumble Bum." And it was a vicious, incredibly, you know. And he said, you know, Gustin says, people, painters would come up to me and say, "Why are you doing this?" Like, you know, he said, "I just could not do this thing anymore," which I thought was false in some ways to my experience. And so I, you know, had to do something really ugly. And then in the act of doing it, he finds like some incredible beauty in it. Those paintings in particular, I've been thinking in the last several years a lot about Philip Gustin and writing a bit about him. And I'm friends in Boston with a guy named William Corbett, who's Jimmy Schuyler's, he edited Jimmy Schuyler's letters actually. But Corbett was close friends with Gustin. And you know, so I loved talking to him about him. And there's a great book that came out this past year called, it's just a collection of Gustin's interviews, studio visits that were recorded. And there's a great interview with Clark Coolidge, the poet Clark Coolidge, who actually put the whole thing together. And that book is the most amazing book about process that I've ever read. It's incredible. Some of the stuff that he says, you know, is just boggling, and especially in relationship to this huge kind of change in his work. But yeah, I mean, I live with a visual artist, and you know, I've always been friends with painters, and so in some sense, yeah, I mean, I really value that time in so many ways. You know, I you know, so much of that time in art, you know, Rauschenberg, you know, just an incredible. Like the great Rauschenberg show at MoMA, the Met, like about 5 or 6 years ago, it was boggling. You know, you just feel like, oh my God, somebody's inventing something. Very few of us invent something new, and you just feel like in a lot of those people that. So there was, and so it has the energy of American, a certain part of American life too at that time. Yeah, yep. So I think we can go. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much, David. That was a great, great treat. I wish we could have you come back and talk about the New York School every week.
I apologize for it being, you know, like this kind of hurried, you know. And I think it was one of these days I'll actually learn a lesson here.
All right, everyone, come back on Thursday.
Yeah.
Thanks.